Say, you know, Lewis, I've often wondered, how did this whole thing start? I mean, you've been in a welter of names that float around in a mystical sort of way in the American scene. Nico has been wedded with the name Velvet Underground and is now divorced from that same name. Andy Warhol has done covers for you, has figured prominently in your work. You have John here, who is a Welchman in the group. You have a drummer who is a secret and a mystery. So what happened? Where did it all start?
Well, we just met down in the village where I was doing songwriting for a company. They would put us in a room and say, write 10 California songs, 10 Detroit songs. And John walked in, and we decided it'd be much better to go play and have fun. So we started playing, and everybody, I had to meet everybody else. It was natural.
So you and John were the original members then?
Yeah.
Where'd you find Sterling?
I met him on the subway. I hadn't seen him in 3 years. And he didn't have any shoes on. And I had boots on. Right? And we took him home.
And what about Mo?
We needed an amplifier. And she had one. Plus, she's an outside drummer. She used to sit, she would work for IBM. And when she'd come home at night, like 5, she'd put on Bo Diddley records and like play every night from 5 to 12. So we figured she'd be the perfect drummer, and she was.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we have an awesome double episode for you. We'll start off by talking with mega collector Mark Satloff, who's been in the news recently for his rather unique record collection. Record fans and collectors are going to want to hear the story about Mark's passion, which has led him to own over 800 copies of a single LP. You see, Mark collects the first pressing of the Velvet Underground and Nico LP. You know, the one with the peelable banana. It's an interesting discussion about record collecting from a guy who really isn't that different from you or I. Then we'll have a chat with Joe Gatt, a gentleman in London who recently discovered a hidden stash of 2-inch multi-track master tapes of Bob Marley's live landmark concerts and had them restored. The Vinyl Guide is the podcast for record nerds, and today it's brought to you by GrooveWasher.com. If you don't clean your records, you are not hearing the full sound. Keep your grooves washed with the Groove Washer. Order one now from GrooveWasher.com. And we're also brought to you today by AsTheRecordTurns.com. AsTheRecordTurns is a killer record shop in Hollywood, California that specializes in original pressing vinyl. No reissues. So if you're looking for a collectible record, call Kevin now at US area code 323-251-4895 or hit him up at AsTheRecordTurns.com. And with that, let's start today's Record Nerd episode.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, thank you for that introduction. Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for joining us here today on The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Glad to be here. Hope everyone's well. Hope you guys recently enjoyed our double episode. Last week we had 2 episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast around jazz and Lee Morgan and Blue Note Records. So if you haven't listened to them yet, go back and check them out. First off, the episode we started off on Monday was an interview with Larry Ridley. He's a bass player who played with the likes of John Coltrane and Sonny Rollins and, of course, Lee Morgan. And he talked to us about what it was like recording with Rudy Van Gelder and the Blue Notes record staff, talked about his experience with some of these old jazz cats, which really is fascinating. So make sure you check out the Larry Ridley episode. And then all of a sudden on Wednesday, gave you another episode, this one featuring Casper Collin, the director of a brand new jazz documentary, I Called Him Morgan. And it premiered in New York last week. It's premiering in Los Angeles this week. So make sure you check out iCalledHimMorgan.com for show times and the trailer, of course. And then we talked a bit about collectible Blue Note records and how to tell a $50 record from a $500 record. So any questions, or if you haven't heard those yet, go back to last week's episodes and check them out. And if you haven't seen it yet, go check out the Record Store Day 2017 release list. They just put it up this last week on recordstoreday.com, a whole list of all the records that they're releasing on Record Store Day, Saturday, April 22nd. Not a day before then. It will only be available on Saturday, April 22nd, and ideally you could pick them up from your local independent record shop. I like what they're doing this year. They're trying to discourage what they call the record flippers, the people who buy them early in the morning for $15 or $20, regular price, and then they sell them on eBay later that day for $60 or $70. It's all about enriching independent record stores. So make sure you support your independent record store Saturday, April 22nd for Record Store Day. Some of the stuff I'm keen to get, the R.L. Burnside release that's coming out, the new Robert Johnson Centennial Edition. They've cleaned up all the Robert Johnson recordings and really made them sound fabulous. So looking forward to having that on vinyl finally. There's a Thelonious Monk recording. It's for kind of a forgotten soundtrack to a film he did in the 60s. I'm not entirely sure of the backstory, but that's kind of how I understand it. And they rediscovered this fact, and they've taken the music from that film and made it available for audio nuts like you or I. So I'm looking forward to that Thelonious Monk record. Of course, the Uriah Heep reissues, those are going to be quite awesome. Those a lot of people are looking forward to that. So make sure you pick those up on Record Store Day 2017 as well. Saturday, April 22nd, head over to recordstoreday.com to check out the list and to find the participating shops near you. So for today's show, we're talking to Mark Satloff and Joe Gatt. Now, Mark is the guy with 800 copies of the Velvet Underground and Nico LP, and Joe is the guy who helped revive a stack of forgotten 2-inch multi-track Bob Marley live tapes and restore them into a playable and hopefully releasable form. Joe actually played me some of this music, and it sounds brilliant. Unfortunately, I can't play them here on the podcast because they're still making deals with the Bob Marley estate, but wow, am I looking forward to that. So that's our show today. Please enjoy. Please leave us a positive iTunes review, and we'll start the show right after this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we've got a major announcement from GrooveWasher.com. Now, most of you know GrooveWasher.com is the number one manual record cleaning system on the market today. But what you may not know is they've just introduced a brand new GrooveWasher starter kit. Now, you and your friends can get a GrooveWasher record cleaning starter kit for just $29.95. Holy smokes, as if the GrooveWasher product couldn't get any better, now there's a starter kit that's going to cost you less than the cost of new records. And if you have a record collection, either large or small, you will need to keep your records clean. Dirty records are a great way to ruin the records and your equipment, so make sure you have a record cleaner of some sort. Sure, there are expensive record machines that can do the job, but geez Louise, some of them cost up to $1,000 or more. For those of us who need to stretch our dollars, there's GrooveWasher.com. Now, for less than $30, you can get a record cleaning kit that will ensure you hear your records at their best and make them last the longest. Plus, you record retailers can now stock the GrooveWasher kit in your store. Check out GrooveWasher.com for more details. So get the very best manual record cleaning system on Earth, and likely Mars and Jupiter too. Pick up the GrooveWasher today at GrooveWasher.com, starting at only $29.95. That's GrooveWasher.com, and they are made in the USA.
Attention, Vinyl Guide listeners!
Look, I've told you guys before about AsTheRecordTurns.com. It's a killer record shop in Hollywood. However, they reach globally, so no matter where you're at in the world, they can help track down original issues and collectible vinyl for your record wish list. Maybe you're looking for a promo copy of an early Stooges LP, or a first pressing of your favorite Kiss record. Maybe you'd like an original James Brown on King Records, or an OG press of Muddy Waters on Chess Records. Or I know what you're looking for. You're looking for a mono copy of John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, on the Orange Impulse label. Well, whatever it is you're looking for, call Kevin at AsTheRecordTurns.com. He can help you find it. Here's the phone number. Grab a pen. U.S. area code 323-251-4895, and tell him that you heard about his shop on the Vinyl Guide. Kevin deals with all original pressings, no reissues. So if you have something on your wish list, or even better yet, if you have a friend or a spouse or a loved one that has a birthday coming up or something you want to celebrate, an anniversary with a song that really means something to to you, Kevin can help you sort that out. I mean, who doesn't love to have an original pressing, collector-quality vinyl? Now, get your pen and paper out and write this number down. As the record turns, U.S. area code 323-251-4895, and that's astherecordturns.com. So listeners to The Vinyl Guide, we all have a little bit of the collector gene. There are some records out there that I know I simply cannot pass up when I see them used. Even though I own several copies at home, I just can't bear to see some of these records stay orphans in their crates or in the record racks. And really, there's no other reason that other than I can't control my urge to take it home with me. Well, right now we have on the phone with us Mark Satloff, who is in a similar situation, but his record collection is a bit more unique. Mark, in a single sentence, how would you describe your record collection?
Well, I have hundreds, maybe about 800 copies of the original pressing of the Velvet Underground and Nico, and you know, they're all different, and each one's a unique piece of art that's been like interacted with. So, you know, you might think they're all literally the same. To me, they're all literally different.
And when you say 800 copies of the original, this is 800 copies of the original pressing, not 200 of the original pressing and 300 of a repress, that sort of thing. You said 800 of the 1967 pressing.
Yes. Well, you know, it gets a little complicated when you talk about what pressing is what, because there were multiple versions that people might, you know, safely call original versions. But I have about, let's say, 750 out of those 800 are pressings that were made between 67 and about 1972 with the you know, the infamous peelable banana. So the short answer is yes, they're mostly original copies, not the repressings. And of those 50 that I mentioned, most of those are first pressings of international editions. So, you know, where you are, there was a New Zealand edition that came out in the 60s or 1970.
So you collect them from around the world. If it is that album, that era, you want at least one copy of it, if not 700-something.
Correct. The international editions aren't as interesting because the, you know, American editions had a banana peel that you could play with. So each one, you know, each copy here has been played with in a different way.
Hmm.
So the international editions didn't have that peelable banana. I'm really interested in the way that people kind of... I'm really fascinated by the people who would have bought this record in the first place. So when I'm buying these records, I'm thinking, you know, not only what is this thing I have in my hand, but I'm trying to think about the person who, in 1967, was weird enough and interesting enough and somehow plugged in enough to buy this record.
That's right, because it wasn't a very popular record back then. It was very, very underground, if I understand the story,
you know,
correctly. Yeah,
yeah, I think the story is slightly overblown. You know, it sold 60,000 copies on vinyl in America from March 1967 to February 1969, and it charted on the Billboard charts fairly low at the bottom of the charts, but it was definitely an underground record, but not a total, you know, totally unknown and not talked about. There were reams of articles written about it and reviews, and, you know, the band toured. So I think they were definitely not a popular band in the you know, standard sense of a, you know, being a 60s hit and mm-hmm. selling, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies, but the idea that they sold nothing at the time is slightly, you know, slightly exaggerated.
So in your time with the records and, of course, talking to the people who bought the records and reading up on it, who were the types of people that bought this record when it first came out?
More or less every story. I've collected a few stories of people who sold me the record that they bought in 1967 or 68. And without exception, they were college kids. They were all college, and they all have a story about going to hearing it in a friend's dorm room. And also a running theme is Andy Warhol, like the idea that I was an Andy Warhol fan. So that got me into them. So that part of the story about this record, that Andy Warhol was really pivotal in getting the record made, and the association with him was helped the band measurably. That's completely true, in my opinion.
And of the original pressings that you have, of course, in America, like you said, they came with this peelable banana. What percentage or how often do you see ones that are completely unpeeled?
So percentage of unpeeled. So, I mean, I can tell you, I'm not even sure I can answer that. They're not, you do see them. I would say 1 in 20 maybe is completely unpeeled. Then there's a pretty large percentage where the person peeled the stem, the very top of the banana, like a little bit, and it ripped off and they put it back on. You see tons of those. Like when you see a banana that looks unpeeled, if you look closely, mostly you're going to see that very top of the peel pulled off and put back on.
They tried it a little bit and they got scared. And
they tried it. Yeah. So that's another thing that fascinates me, is like watching how far people got in peeling the banana. Cause, your listeners are probably familiar with the record. At the very top of the record, it says peel slowly and see. So, I mean, that's what Andy Warhol is saying to you, is peel slowly and see. So a lot of people took him up on it. I would say most people took him up on it and started peeling it slowly, and they, see what happens. In a lot of cases, the stem came off. And then I have many, many, I have every grade in between, every gradation in between, fully, completely brand new to totally peeled and beat up and stabbed and punched. So I love watching the way someone got halfway across, and sometimes they peel the banana halfway and then they'll take a knife and cut it so that it's like a smooth edge. I have some that have been halfway peeled off and it's still the peel is still dangling. But I'm always thinking of this person bought this record in 1968. And then they sat down and they're listening to it, and then they've got this record in their hand, and it's freaking them out because they're listening to it, and it's the music's wild, And you have to remember 1967. What else is? What's on the pop charts at that time? And you're hearing this record that is, mind blowing, and you're peeling the banana. So, I think about it a lot. I probably overthink it when I'm looking at these records, but it's one of the beauties of this collection, and what I think makes it, each record different. So there's kind of a story behind each copy.
And it's not just the banana that people interact with. There's a lot of white space, a lot of places for people to put their own markings,
a lot of white
or
space.
Drawings.
Yeah. You're probably a record collector yourself. You know that a lot of records have someone's name written on it. You were at college, you were at a dorm, you had to write your name on your record. So a lot of them have the names written on them. I have one that says Andy's Whore Hole written on it. I have ones with, lots of ones with people's names on them, lots of doodling, psychedelic artwork. A good number that have been, in people's basements and gotten water damage and they're moldy. So kind of every variation of what can happen to a mostly white page, you're absolutely right. They get dirty. There's coffee stains on some of them. A few have ash marks on them, burn marks.
Do you have any autograph ones from the band members?
Yeah, so I have a bunch that are autographed. I have several that are Lou Reed, signed by Lou Reed. I have two that have the name Andy Warhol written on them. I'm not 100% sure. I think they may be his signature, but I never got them authenticated. I think I have a Mo Tucker, and I may have a Sterling Morrison. I think I have a John Cale. fact, the first, I don't know if you want to go into this part, but the first record that I ever collected, like the first collector's copy I got was when I, it was in 1987, and it was at an antiques mall next to where I worked down on Canal Street in Manhattan. And I remember I would like visit it. It was up on the wall. I would visit it for months, thinking like, could I spend the $100 that, you know, he was asking for it? And that had a signature on it, and I finally bought it from him. He told me it was Andy Warhol's signature, and this is, you know, pre-internet era, so you couldn't really super easily check that.
He had
that
to take his
thing.
Word for it, yeah. He's the record guy,
take his
he
word
must
for
know.
It. Yeah. Well, it took me years to figure it out, but I finally figured out it was Lou Reed's signature and not Andy Warhol's. And when once you see the copy, you're like, duh, that's not Andy Warhol. That's clearly Lou Reed. But, you know, this is before you could sort of check things easily.
And was that your first copy? Was that what started what lit the fuse for what became your work?
Well, yeah, I guess, I mean, if you want to back up like a second, I came to college in the early 1980s, and a friend of mine who was exponentially cooler than me knew the Velvet Underground and got me into them. And, you know, to answer the question before it's asked, I started a band. We played Velvet Underground covers. And so I knew about the Velvet Underground in college, like my first year of college. But then there was this night at my friend's house, Steve, and it was late at night. It was like really dark. It was in this big open dorm room, pretty empty, and I just remember, you know, a long night of mind-altering substances, and he puts this record on, and I just remember, like, staring at it and hearing the music, and that was a real life-changing moment, hearing the weird sounds that were coming out of it that I'd never heard before, hearing the singing, which it's partly pretty on some songs and on other songs kind of atonal and harsh, and these lyrics that are like you didn't really hear lyrics like that. And then I remember I was looking out, there's picture windows, a whole wall of windows, and this apartment building this dorm was on a cliff overlooking Harlem. And so you're 20 stories in the air. And I'm like listening to, Waiting for the Man and thinking like that's Lexington and 125. And I'm looking out the window at Lexington and 125. So it was a real mystical moment of really hearing this record. So that's what got me into this band and this music. And right around that time, there was a big reissue campaign, and all of the Velvet Underground records plus new ones were available now at a record store, easily, any record store, you know. And before that, in the early 80s, it was probably not impossible, but like I just remember you couldn't go into any record store and just walk to the Velvet Underground bin. But after 1984, that's when I really started listening a lot to the Velvet Underground, when I could get the records and hear the new records that had been uncovered at that time.
So you had a connection with the music and, you know, spiritual and mystical and all things that came into it, and that's
yeah.
Great. When you buy a copy of it, what makes you get the second one, then the third? What makes you continue that process?
Right. So I guess it's like anything, any stamp, like stamp collecting or coin collecting or butterfly collecting. You know, once I bought that first copy, I started learning that there were, you know, different variations. There's the mono version. There's the stereo version. And bit by bit, learning more about the, like the collector part of it. And then just every time I went to a record fair, I would look for them, and I would pick them up. And I think somewhere around that time in the 80s, there was a discography that came out. So finally I had something to, you know, a reference point to say, oh, that's the mono version with the Emerson cover. And now I mean, I guess the word to use is scholarship, but there are people around the world who've really studied this record and found all the minute different variations. There are song, you know, timings that are different on different versions. There are, there's something called the East Coast pressing and the West Coast pressing. Somebody was able to like research it and figure out that, you know, what the different like font, you know, and the one record has side A, side B, the other one has side one, side two. So besides, you know, what I've already talked about regarding the, you know, the idea that each one of these has a kind of a story behind it, you can go and look at these, like any collector, these like minute variations. So I'm not really, I don't really track those variations or count them or even like study them, but I want to. Someday I actually want to sit down and look at all of these and like, you know, count them and say, this is that version, this is the other version. Oh, this is the West Coast version with you know, the 2-inch band around the label. So
so you don't have in your record collection, you don't have, this shelf is the Torso covers. This shelf is the Monarch.
No, not yet. No, but over this past summer, for the first time, I did finally, I like started early sorting of them, and I sorted them between versions that based on the cover, how much banana is on the cover. So I'm actually looking forward to the next step, which is going to be finding all the mono copies, finding all those Emerson, you know, the Emerson copies, which the Emerson copy is, you know, quick side story. The record came out in March 1967, and there was a image of a Warhol scenester named Eric Emerson that was projected over the band in the back cover photo. And the story goes that he called up the record label and said, you know, I want a few bucks for that. And they pulled it off the shelf. And first they put a big sticker on the back over his picture that just said The Velvet Underground and Nico, and then repressed the cover with his photo airbrushed out. So if you're a collector and you're seeing it on eBay, that's the airbrush cover, the third version.
Is that Emerson story the same as the Torso cover? Are we talking the same thing, or is that
yeah,
are they separate?
That's okay. That's the same thing. That's the Torso cover. You're seeing Eric Emerson's body, his torso and face. That's why it's called the Torso or Emerson. A little tip, if you're looking on eBay, many, many sellers misidentify their copies as original, you know, the original pressing. And I think if you're like the nerd collector, the original pressing is the one with Emerson. It's the very first, the March 1967 pressing. And then it was out of the shelves for months during 1967. And I'm not exactly sure, maybe late in the year came back on the shelves, but you know, that derailed their career it derailed the beginnings of their career as a recording.
And it was just paused simply because they had to rework that back image.
Yeah, exactly. I did read something, and I haven't been able to re-find it, but where Eric Emerson, this torso man, said that he'd never really threatened a lawsuit, but just said, like, give me a few bucks, and they overreacted, but I can't really vouch for that.
Record companies will go a long way to avoid giving people money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's also, I believe, copies of the record without the song "Sunday Morning." Is that correct, or are those?
So yeah, that is a there is one copy that anyone knows about, and it has been known in the Uber collector world, not really by me, but it has been known. You know, its existence has been known. I read on I read online that it sold on eBay a number of years ago for $800, and I think what you're referring to is it recently resurfaced on eBay at a price of $25,000 or $22,000. It exists. It's in Australia, by the way.
Oh.
In case you were curious. Yes.
Let me know if you want me to pick it up for you.
Yes, please. So I'm not really. I mean, it doesn't really. If it was $800, I might consider it. But it appears to be a actual, real, pressing, yet unexplained. No one's quite sure why it was pressed and when, and exactly what the music is, like what versions of the songs they are.
So this is only one copy. There's not, you haven't seen, you know, 20 copies somewhere. This is just one.
Yeah, there's only one copy, and if you look at any of the collector sites or look around online for it, this is the only one that anyone's ever found. It's not it wasn't commonly known until the last month or two. But now that, you know, the person put it on eBay to, you know, gin up some publicity, and he's done a good job. It's a really interesting record. No one knows, you know, no one knows why it doesn't have Sunday Morning on it. I mean, Sunday Morning was I believe, if I'm getting the story right, was the last song. Like, the whole record was recorded, and then the producer, his name's Tom Wilson, one of the producers, said, you know, we need a hit single. Which, if you listen to Sunday Morning, gorgeous, amazing, beautiful song, but I would never think hit single, even in 1966 when it came out. And so he, you know, so they added Sunday Morning. So it does make sense that Sunday Morning is not on this particular pressing. Like, if any song is not going to be on the record, that would be it. It was recorded at a different time than the rest of the record.
And even the cover art doesn't say anything about Sunday Morning?
No, it does say Sunday Morning. It appears to be the regular stock first pressing, what they call the torso cover of the record. It appears to be the manufactured commercial album.
Everything's
packaging.
The same except no Sunday Morning on the record.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly.
Now, that's interesting because there's that one off. And then, of course, there's the recent story. Well, I don't know how recent it is anymore. Several years back, about the acetate. Can you talk a little bit about that story?
Sure. So the acetate story is that, you know, Velvet Underground recorded in New York in, I believe it was April 1966, at a recording studio called Scepter. And what was his name? Norm Dolph, something like that. Norman. And that the guy who arranged for the sessions made, you know, took the tape and made an acetate, which, you know, do I have to explain what an acetate is?
For those of you who don't know what an acetate is, it's a one-off that people take with very limited play. It's for artists to be able to listen to at home and evaluate the music.
Right. So he made this acetate, and the story goes that he gave it to Andy Warhol. That the story goes that he took it to record companies to try and get the band signed, and then he took it to Andy Warhol, or gave it back to Andy Warhol, and that somehow, you know, after that, 1967, and I think it was about 10 years ago, it somehow got out of Andy Warhol's possession and into a box of records that were then sold at a tag sale in New York, in Chelsea, New York, for... again, this is the way the story goes. I don't know if it's how accurate it is, but the guy paid 75 cents for it. And then, you know, it contains slightly different recordings of some of the songs that ended up being on the record. And if I remember the story right, there's two of them. There's two acetates, and I think maybe Mo Tucker had one, but that acetate version, that acetate was eventually released on one of the box sets, one of the Velvet Underground and Nico box sets, I think. So
the tape for that session, I'm assuming that the Velvet Underground recorded onto a tape initially. They did a little bit of a mix, then they made a couple acetates perhaps, but the tape doesn't exist anywhere either, right?
Well, this is all going to have to be double checked. I'm pretty sure that on the liner notes to the reissue of the Nico, the 45th anniversary version, they do have the acetate on that, you know, in its full version plus a couple other songs from that period. And I'm pretty sure the credits say certain of the songs were from a tape, and certain were from an acetate. So. They may have found that tape. They may have found that original half-inch or quarter-inch tape.
or part of it or something. So
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting.
It's, you're a little over my head right now. I could get you the answer if I pulled out the, you know, the box set, but I don't have it memorized. But I think that's the way the story goes.
So let's get back to your collection really quick, because I'm fascinated.
Sure.
I actually have a similar approach when it comes to Led Zeppelin II, not to the scale that you have. I've got probably 35-40 copies.
Well, that's crazy.
Yeah, well, my wife agrees with you, by the way.
I'm joking.
Obviously, I'm joking. I know, of course. There's the guy who collects White albums, who has you know, upwards of a thousand. Are you and him buddies? Have you talked? Is there a group that we can join?
I remember a few years ago there was a New York Times story about him, and I applaud him. I think it's great. I remember him having a more thought out theory of his collection and the art than I do. I think ultimately very, very similar. You know, he's got this White album they've been messed with. They're all numbered, so they're all different. So other than the fact, I guess what I don't remember about him is, does he love the White album? Like, is he obsessed with the White album, the music on the White album?
I would say he'd have to be.
You know, maybe. I really, really don't know the answer. For me, you know, I've gotten into this because I listen to the Velvet Underground all the time. It's like my, you know, I'm every time I listen to the Velvet Underground and Nico, for example, I hear something new that I'm like, did I ever hear that before? Or I'll remember that I heard something 10 years ago and I heard it again today. Like it could be a note in a solo or, you know, glass breaking or something, and or a lyric. And so, you know, every time I get one of these records, it kind of reminds me of how much I love this band and this band's music.
How often do you listen to the Velvet Underground and Nico album?
Well, you know, I listen to the Velvet Underground almost every day or every other day, and periodically listen to the Velvet Underground and Nico album or some of the reissues where they've added things to it. But I can't really say how many times I specifically listen to the Velvet Underground and Nico.
Okay. So it's not on a couple times a day?
No.
Okay.
But I'm listening to Velvet Underground music because, let's just say that the Velvet Underground, this album is amazing. But I think every album that the band released is amazing. There are some years where I'm really into Loaded, and I'll listen to Loaded over and over again. There's some years where I'm obsessed with White Light, White Heat, the music on it. Last year, the year before, they put out a remarkable live album, which is multiple CDs of the VU playing in 1969, and I listened to that for months and months on headphones. It was amazing.
Have you ever met anyone of the Velvet Underground?
Well, let's see. I met Lou Reed twice, and when I say meet, basically, you know, shaking hands. So we're saying meet fairly loosely. And then I met Sterling Morrison and Mo Tucker, Sterling the guitar player and Mo Tucker the drummer, at a party. They had a party when the live album, live from their reunion tour, came out, and I think it was 93 or 94, and I met them, and that was basically shaking hands. Though I remember Sterling Morrison was like really friendly, and you know, I was like, oh, Sterling, I'm the hugest fan, which, you know, a guy like that gets it every day. And I'm like, oh, Sterling, I'm the hugest fan. He goes, yeah, man, the 60s, it was like anything was possible. I remember that from Sterling. And I have met John Cale. I sat across the table from him once for something. And then I went to, there was a talk they did at the New York City, New York Public Library. And that was Lou and Mo Tucker and Doug Yule. And I just can't remember if John Cale was there. I'm blanking on that. But I went to that and I saw them all there and, maybe shook their hands when I got my book signed or something.
So clearly, Velvet Underground's connoisseur, fan.
Yep.
You collect other copies as well? Like, how many copies of, for instance, White Light, White Heat do you have?
I would say between 10 and 20. That one also has some interesting variations, and like there's, you know, the promo copy with the yellow label and promo copy with the white label. And looking at it now, it looks like it's about 10 to 20.
Do you also collect copies of the Sunday morning single?
Yes, I have two or three or maybe four copies of the stock copy, which is the hard, really hard to find, that was released, you know, in stores to, you know, for the public. And then I have also the DJ copies that were sent to radio stations.
Are there any copies of the Velvet Underground and Nico LP that you're missing?
In the last year, I've started looking at the international pressings, you know, France and Japan and Canada, et cetera. And I don't really have the checklist down, but I think there's a few of those that I'm missing. I'm not really sure they're that hard to find. They were, in a lot of countries, the first pressings came well after 1967, you know, in the 70s. But I have the Canadian, the New Zealand version, I think. So maybe you can research this for me. How many copies do you think would have been pressed of the Velvet Underground and Nico for the New Zealand Australia market in New Zealand?
Okay. I'm writing down that question and I'll circle back with that.
I'm just curious, like, it's got to be pretty rare. I mean, how many could they have made? Anyway, so yeah, I think maybe I need the French version, but that's my latest thing, is international edition.
Over the next few days, compile a bit of a list. I'll put it on the website, and we'll see if anyone, any of our international listeners,
okay,
can help you out with it. Aside from the autographed ones, which one is the most, I guess, the most valuable, and which one is the most special to you?
Well, the most special one is the first one I bought, which happens to be autographed, and I think the autograph was a bonus, you know, because I wasn't out to buy an autographed copy. The rarest copy I have, let's see, the most valuable copy would be, I have a sealed copy of the very first pressing, the mono edition, sealed in shrink wrap.
Full banana,
untouched, looks like it. Literally looks brand new. It's awesome. And there's this obscure edition which is called the Celebrity Series edition. It's got the words Celebrity Series on the label. I kind of think that might be the rarest, but they're not that valuable. No one really, you know, they're not really that collectible value-wise. There's also this the fabled white label promo, which is, you know, from the West Coast. And I think I have two or three of those. Those are pretty rare.
Those are the DJ Advance ones. Now the white labels were from the West Coast, and the yellow labels were from the East Coast. Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I have like 10 of the yellow. Those up until the last year or two, those were pretty easy to affordably find on eBay.
Do you have a price limit? Like when you're looking at Velvet Underground, if it's, you know, over X amount of dollars?
Yeah, I have a mental number. And when I look at a copy, I sort of like say, that's what I want to pay for it. And really for the last really for the at least the last 5 years, I'm really only looking at the most beat up copies. Like right now, the copies that are most messed up, the covers are most messed up or have been drawn on or modified, those are really the only ones I'm interested in.
Okay. The ones with the personal story, some sort of history behind them.
Yeah, also price-wise, they're the cheapest. The better copies are starting to, you know, go beyond my price range.
You know, I'm just doing a bit of a mental math here. You said 60,000 copies were sold of the original pressing in the U.S.
Yes, that's, by the way, that's according to Nico's royalty statement, which is online somewhere.
Okay.
It's actually 58,500.
So 58,500, and you own 750 of them. You own like 1.3% of the total number of Velvet Underground and Nico albums that were pressed in the late 60s.
Well, there's qualifiers, so I just want to, you know, it gets a little wonky, but I'm subtracting at least 150 from that 750 for copies that may have been sold after March 1969.
Okay.
Because the only number we have that I have that I've seen that is you know believable is Nico's royalty statement for the first 2 years of its release.
But that's still 1%.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say it's 1%.
Wow. I wonder how many Led Zeppelin 2 albums I'm going to have to buy to make 1% of that.
Well, look, there you go. If you're collecting Led Zeppelin 2, that sold billions, right? Multi-millions.
Oh, my wife is not going to like where this is leading.
Yeah.
So. And,
well, why do you buy that? Why do you buy that record? Is it because of the music? Is it because you like the album cover? Is there all minute variations?
There's a couple of reasons. Number one is, yeah, I think it is the blueprint for rock music, really, for the 70s. I mean, it came mm-hmm. out, and I think it was a total game changer for what happened to rock and roll for at least the next decade. So that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the versions I collect are specific pressings that were mastered by a guy named Bob Ludwig. And
there you go. Yeah,
they're hard to come by. There's a story behind it to where they were pressed and then recalled because really the sound is so vibrant, so strong. Bass and the drums are so punchy that it made cheap record players skip. And
wow.
And so it, generally, when a product is recalled, it's because it's faulty or there's a problem. But in this case, the product was recalled because it sounded too good. And so
there you go.
I seek out Bob Ludwig but copies, but I also have, like you say, a mental number, like I'm not going to pay more than X amount of, sometimes
yeah.
I'll find them for $10 or if it's pristine I'll pay $100 but
me too we're peas in a pod, so
yeah. Well, I don't think we're alone. I think there's a quite a few other people, even if it's, you know, some people may have four or five copies of, you know.
Yeah.
I got a friend of mine who collects Kate Bush albums, and he's got four or five copies of each one, and, you know,
yeah.
That's just what
I'm with him. I'm with you. I'm with him.
So you've got 800 copies now. What is the end game?
Well, let's see. Next summer, I'll sit and I'll organize them, and I'll get to, like, look at each one and be the collector nerd and say this is the East Coast pressing and this is the one with the, you know, this is the mono copy. I don't have an end game. No. When I first started, when I'm at the first like 50 or 100, I was thinking, wow, this would be so cool if they were all on a wall in ascending order from how much banana there is. And it would be like the coolest, just a whole wall, and you'd see, like, no banana, and it would, like, creep up to, like, the perfect banana. I had that in my mind at one point, but that's been done. It hasn't been done with the banana album, but I think it's, I don't have an end game.
Can you foresee the time when you look at your collection and it's gone to 1,000?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm adding, you know, yeah, absolutely. So call me in maybe 3-4 years. I think I'll get to 1,000. I never had a number in mind, you know. And you've probably heard this story from other collectors or collectors' wives, how it started to take over the whole space, you know. All of my other records, and I have thousands of, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 other records, have been pushed off the shelves and are now in boxes. So I missed the rest of the collection.
Yeah, well, you live in New York, too, so I mean, you are working with a space limitation.
Yeah, space is at a premium, yeah.
Yeah, so the collection will keep expanding. Your wife will keep understanding.
Yeah.
And that's how it's going to be.
Yeah.
We wish you all the luck, and yeah, I guess we'll look forward to...
I would just like to say, my final words...
Yes.
My last words are, it's passion, not obsession.
That's a good ethos. I'm going to talk to my wife about those words right now.
There you go.
Mark, thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I appreciate the call. Take care.
No worries. Cheers. So as record collectors, we are always dreaming about the next big find, the eureka moment, the time when we dig through the crates and we find this incredible piece of music history that was left to us by an audio lover years ago. We always dream of that moment. And our friend, the show here, Joe Gatt, is on the line, and he's going to talk about this incredible find that came about in the UK. So you've recently been in the news due to the fact that you have taken ownership of some lost tapes from Bob Marley. Yeah?
Oh, okay, yes. Well, the story is like this, basically. A friend of mine who works for a clearing company, basically they call his company when they're refurbishing a place or renovating it or rebuilding it, or before they knock it down, they call these people and they tell them, get rid of everything. But anyway, he came across these tapes and they looked old and very, very badly full of mold, and some of them wet as well. But and he asked the guy who asked them to clear the place, you know, it says Bob Marley on these things. He said, "Yeah, yeah, I know, but they're all, you know, they're no good." So, yeah, he was supposed to, you know, get rid of them, but he called me and I said, "Silly, look, let's have a look first." So,
he knew you were a Bob Marley fan. He's clearing out this old basement or whatever. He sees these tapes that say something about Bob Marley, and he knows his friend Joe is a Bob Marley fan. So he gives you a call.
Well, that's correct. He knows I'm a big music fan, but also he remembered from some time ago, we were at a wedding together, and I said, you know, Bob Marley song came on, and I said, oh, I've seen Bob Marley in concert. He said, wow. And so I told him, yeah, I was there in 1975 at the Lyceum. So it's something that he remembered. So when he saw the tapes and it says Bob Marley, he thought of me straight away. So yeah, he called me and... he took them home, and I went along and had a look. They were very, very bad, but all the same, even if we couldn't do anything with them, it's something that you keep, you know. I could tell straight away they were 24 track master tapes, you know. And so I took hold of them, and I started to... you know, I went on the internet and see what they usually do with these things, and phoning around. And as it happens, a few days later, I was with a friend of mine who was a jazz singer. His name is Louis Hoover. And we went to visit a friend. And on the way back, a Bob Marley song came on the radio. And I said, wow. and it just clicked. And I said, well, look, I got hold of some tapes. And he's taking it off lightly, you know. And he said, what do you mean? I said, I've got some Bob Marley tapes, you know, 24 track. you know, we decided to see what we can do with it. He's got more contacts than I have, because obviously he's been a singer for many years. And that's how it started.
So you had these tapes, and you knew when you got the boxes from your friend. Your friend was just going to throw them away. He was paid to actually throw them away.
Well, he was told to get rid of them, yeah. Yes. But so, I don't think he would have thrown them away. He would have probably put them aside. I don't know, but they were meant for the, yeah. Yeah, another few hours, they would have ended up there, yes, if he decided not to keep them. That's right, yeah.
So you ran down, you grabbed these tapes. I guess you threw them in the boot of your car, you put them in your house. You mentioned them to a friend, and yeah. Then he saw the value in them straight away. He was very curious about them.
Well, yes, but we both saw the value, but he knew more than I did that something could be done to these, even though they were in a very bad state. He knew that maybe, you know, out of a 1 hour reel, you can get 10, 15 minutes, you know, from the middle. That's still okay.
Right.
And that's what we were aiming for. And when we eventually found Martin Nichols, you know, who is the guy who restored the tapes, and we took them to him, in the west of England, in a place called Weston Supermare. Mm-hmm. You know, he took one look. We could tell by the look on his face. You know, they're pretty bad. And he said, look, yeah, leave them with me. I'll see what I can do. But, you know, they are in a bad way.
Right.
So he said, look, obviously, this is going to take time and money, but he had other things to do. He said, but it'll be a labor of love. You know, it's Bob Marley. We can't just, you know, leave him. And the whole thing, you know, took him a year.
The tapes themselves were in a basement of some sort, and it was damp. What were the conditions when you went over to get the tapes? What were the conditions that you found them in?
Well, apparently the they were in the basement of a hotel, and the hotel had a flood. I don't know if it's a flood from weather, you know, but they were in a bad way. So not only they had dampness in them, they had like gunk, you know, like muddy water and whatever. It was really bad. Because Martin told us, what he had to do, he had to soak them in distilled water for some time, and then that would bring all the all the dirt out, and then, you know, dry them, and then painstakingly, like 6 inches at a time, doing them with a cotton wool and stuff like that. And it took him ages and ages just to do one reel, and apparently I think the first reel he did was blank.
No. That was the practice.
Yeah, and then this, I think the second reel was really bad. as you open it, it was falling apart. But the third reel, when he finished it and he put it on, before he put it on, they had to go in like an oven, a special oven for this sort of thing. To dry them, and it brings the stuff that's in the tapes, you know, to come back to life, sort of thing. It was on the third reel that he, you know, he heard some music, and that's when he started to get really excited and decided to carry on, because, you know, like I said, at first he was going to give up. Especially when you do, you know, a whole reel. I think he spent probably about 3 days on the first reel, and then to put it on, and it was empty.
Inside the box, was there any documentation that would say, you know, the concert date or any other information that?
Yes, inside the boxes. I think somebody had changed the boxes, because the boxes weren't. Although the boxes were old, the boxes that couldn't have been the original because the tapes were so bad And if the tapes were in the box, then the box would be even worse because the box was made of cardboard. So I think somebody changed the boxes, but we don't know. We don't know the whole story yet.
Do we know how the tapes got there? Do we know why they were abandoned there for so many years?
Well, we're looking into that, but it's probably something to do with a sound engineer. They were with a sound engineer. Obviously, I can't give any details right now.
Okay, all right. It's you're still piecing the story together.
Yes.
Okay, and out of the tapes that you picked up, how many tapes did you pick up, and how many tapes are listenable?
Well, there were 13 tapes. One was empty, and two were too damaged to even try to do anything with. So we're left with 10 tapes, 10 reels full of very good music.
Mm. And are there any plans to release that music?
Well, we're hoping to. We're obviously in discussion with, we own the tapes, physical tapes, but we don't own the music. The music belongs to Bob Marley and the family and obviously Universal, who Universal own Island Records. Bob Marley was on Island Records. So yes, we're in discussion. Our solicitor is in discussion, and yeah, we're hoping to reach some sort of an agreement. Yeah, we did this for the music. We want everybody to hear the music. Although some of the music actually has been released before, but we've now established that we have the original masters.
Yeah. And you were at the Lyceum show in London, which is one of the tapes. There were, I believe, four or five shows. There was the Lyceum in London from 75, Hammersmith Odeon from 76, the Rainbow from 77, and a Paris show from 1978. So really, there's 4 years just across a brilliant period in Bob Marley's career. You were at the Lyceum show. How was it listening to that show for the first time in 40 years?
Oh, well, when we went to the studio, when Martin called us to go and have a listen, we actually asked him. I said, well, you know, how are they? How is it? And he said, well, he didn't let on. He said, well, just come and listen. So we weren't expecting much. So we got there, we sat down full of anticipation. And honestly, when Martin turned the sound up, he put the faders up, we couldn't believe the sound that came out of those speakers. And the hair at the back of my neck stood up because it took me back to the Lyceum, you know, 1975, which is actually a lot of people are calling that actual gig was one of his best ever.
Wow.
I mean, that was the only time I saw him, but... it was one of the, I've seen Led Zeppelin and I've seen Pink Floyd twice. And I've seen most of them, but it's one of the most memorable concerts that I've ever been to.
And so, do you have any plans to find any Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd tapes in the near future?
That would be good.
So that's really interesting. So Joe, thanks for spending time with us. I mean, you never know what you're going to find, what's going to turn up, a piece of history here or there. And you've had this incredible opportunity, and also want to commend you for really doing the right thing for the music community in helping get these tapes restored so the audio can be heard. And hopefully you'll be able to work a deal to where not only will you recoup what you've spent in restoring the audio, but so the music fans can listen to these shows as well.
Yes. Well, that's the whole idea. I mean, you know, like we said, another few hours and these things could have ended up, you know, in the dumpster. But honestly, it was like it's a message from above that somebody had to find these things, and I was there to say let's do something with them, you know. And my partner Louis Hoover, Martin, the guy who restored them, he did an amazing job.
thanks again for spending time with us, Joe. We do appreciate it, and we look forward to hearing more about the story as it develops. All right, Mark and Joe, thank you for joining us today on The Vinyl Guide. Much appreciated, and good luck with your continued efforts there. Mark, we'll talk to you when you reach 1,000 Velvet Underground and Nico LPs. And Joe, we look forward to hearing the news about these Bob Marley live concert releases. They sound fabulous. They sound excellent. So can't wait to hear them in my living room. All right, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for listening. Make sure to leave us a positive iTunes review. Tell all your record nerd friends about us. And above all, till we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.